My friends, we're turning to the Acts of the Apostles tonight, where we had our reading, and to that marvelous 12th chapter. We want to look at that fifth verse, though we'll keep the passage open and look at one or two other passages there as well. Vital questions. Number two, prayer of force or farce. And what does it say there? So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. Prayer of force or farce. I suppose the problem with some people, especially those who don't yet believe, is that they're afraid it may turn out to be a farce, that they've been conned into believing a fairy story. We know the feeling. Some time back, when we lived in another vicarage, where we had one of these vicarage lawns that stretches out, one evening I was standing on the lawn, the darkness was closing in. Looking across, I saw what looked like it was a dark shape on the lawn. I thought, we've got a cat. So I went up to it, and I said, hello, 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 psst. And it didn't move, so I went closer to shoo it away. And suddenly I saw I was talking to a watering can. Now, when you do something like that, you know the feeling. You look around quickly to see if anybody has spotted you, making a fool of yourself. And I think that is the feeling with some people when it comes to things like God, faith, prayer. And they say to themselves, I do not want to be made a fool of. I do not want to talk to the thin air. I do not want to be believing something that is actually empty. But once we've entered into this thing called Christianity and received the Christian revelation as it centers in Jesus Christ, once we've acknowledged that there is a somebody who's been revealed to us through Christ, as the Father, the whole picture changes. We're into a relationship then, we realize. And we talk, not to somebody we can see, but nevertheless we talk upon a well-founded faith to somebody who we've come to love, to trust, and to follow. Because we love him, we talk to him. Now there's nothing like a crisis, of course, to bring prayer to something of a head, and to bring a prayer gathering to life. So when we have this story here in Acts 12, I'm sure it's recorded for a purpose for us. Here we are in the early stages of the New Testament church and its emergence. Such an emergence could never really be a tranquil, peaceful affair. Heads were getting cracked right and left. Stephen had already been stoned to death, the event triggering off a major persecution and a major conversion, that of Paul. But now it was Herod's turn to crack the whip. And dispatching one of the precious and irreplaceable 12 apostles with the sword, James, the brother of John, he next turns his attention to the rock man, Peter, clapping him into a top security jail under heavy guard. All the Herods of the Bible seem to be bad people. Have you identified them all in your mind yet? This one was Herod Agrippa I, and he was a nephew of Herod Antipas, who was the murderer of John the Baptist. This Herod was also a grandson of Herod the Great, who plotted to kill the infant Jesus, and was, of course, the man behind the massacre of those little children at Bethlehem. The Herods were all murderers. This one, Agrippa, was a political man, and as so often appears in history, the church was caught up in the tide of political events and affected by the actions of a political man. Now, the political decision was quite a sound one. Execute one of the top three apostles, James, incarcerate the number one man with a view to having a showpiece trial for the people in a few days' time. And so the interest was building for this trial. But prayer changed the whole thing. So, verse 5. Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. Now, of course, in our reading, we've already blown the end of the story. You and I know very well what happened. What with the angelic visitation, the breaking of the shackles, and the opening of gate after gate, one after another, until finally the prisoner, with the help of his supernatural escort, reaches the open street and finally says to himself, "It's not a dream, it's happened." And he makes straight, wherefore, the church prayer gathering. Yes, there had been continuing, prevailing prayer. That is the factor that the authorities had not counted upon. Consequently, as the next morning dawned, we read in verse 18, and I can see the historian Luke writing it with that masterly understatement, there was no small stir among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. No small stir. There was bedlam that morning. The detainee had done a sort of Houdini on them all. And no one would ever know how it had been done. But you and I know, thanks to Luke's careful chronicling of the whole affair, it had quite a lot to do with prayer. Not that prayer is in any way an insurance policy against adversity. When the footballer Kevin Keegan once said, "I turn to God when I need him," it was evidently a last resort kind of God that he was thinking of, to be used only in emergency. The true person of prayer does not think like that. We're not to turn to God because we need him, but because we love him. The first sign of a new Christian is that he or she begins to learn about prayer as a way of life. We learn to take prayer into every day with us. The events, the big events, the small events, the happinesses, the disasters, the decisions, the dull in-between bits as well. We learn to take prayer into that day so that as our head comes off the pillow, the first thing, the alarm clock goes, or whatever it is that happens, already we're beginning to see the film of the new day in front of our minds as it unfolds. And we're beginning to bring God into it. "Lord, a new day. Thank you. Good morning, Lord. I'm here." And we start like that. The test of a true church can be made as anything else, as much as anything else, on its prayer life. Just as a new Christian begins to pray, however badly, however stumblingly, we want to be in communication with our Creator. So the test of a real church is, does it pray together? Prayer is the test for so much. It's either a force or a farce. Some people go through the motions. And some churches go through the motions. And we do either take it seriously or simply go through the motions, pattering through a few well-worn phrases, not unlike the way some people turn their beads. But I want to encourage us in this address because in all probability, most of us feel guilty and inadequate about prayer. I was once asked to write a book on prayer, and I said in my introduction how much of a hypocrite I felt writing that book. So none of us feel good about this. Therefore, the idea of these next few minutes is not to rub salt into our wounds, but rather to think positively and buoyantly of how we can get better as people of prayer and how we can get better as a church that prays. In this New Testament church of Acts, prayer does seem to have been the touchstone, the test for a great deal. Let's observe, first of all, that prayer is the test of our unity. I'll say that again. Prayer is the test of our unity in the church. Look at verse 5 again. "So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church." Now, he doesn't say that prayer was made by his friends or by a few people that were scattered around. The statement is that the church prayed. There was agreement about it. They came together. God's divine strategy is, wait for it, the church. Jesus said, "On this rock," as he said to Peter, "on this rock I will build my church." and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. That's God's divine strategy. Of course people can't believe it. It's been written off time and again to the media that church is a joke and only hits the headlines or makes the screen at all in the context of a farce. Here in this account, Herod thought that he had disposed of the church quite well by shutting up one of its leaders, the rock man, on whose preaching Christ had promised to build his church. So he'd take him away and pop him behind bars, and that is the end. But he hadn't reckoned on the power of a prayer gathering, the coming together in unity and agreement of the church. Monty's strategy in the war, General Montgomery, his strategy, as he said repeatedly, was that you do not scatter your troops thinly across the countryside in a long line and advance like that, but you bunch all your resources together and in one great effort you punch a hole through the enemy lines. So it is surely spiritually that a church, a local church, is the gathering of people who are in agreement. Yes, they worship together. They witness together. Some of them will go out to Oxford Circus and do their bit. All of them are witnessing in place of influence, whether it be the home or a place of work or among friends. But there is an agreement, a unanimity. We are here as God's people in this place. And we will therefore pray together and work together and club our resources together so that as one single entity, we can do as much damage to the kingdom of darkness as we possibly can. We believe in the church then. We see it as God's divine strategy in the world. We do not cast it off or laugh at poor old Mother Church. We say the church is God's strategy. We work together. We worship together. We pray together. We encourage one another in this church family, and we demonstrate our unity in the vital field of prayer. That means that a healthy church has a reservoir of prayer, if I may call it that. We pray whether there is a crisis or not, because we love God and want to be in his will. Then if there should be a crisis that bursts upon us, there is always then that underlying confidence that God will hear because he's heard us before. God will act because we know from experience that he does act. It's the test of our unity, coming together in prayer. I'll give an example. My sister, Elizabeth, is married to a clergyman and they work in a church in Norwich. And in their very early days there in that church, there was a problem with some of the metal ornaments on the top of the roof. I don't know what they were exactly, but they weren't very vital, but they were ornaments and they were getting loose and one of them had already fallen down and it was dangerous. So the authorities said, you'll have to do that up properly, get all the ornaments off, and it's going to be very difficult because there was no real access, so you'll have to put up expensive scaffolding. The whole thing will be £3,000. And Gordon and Elizabeth said to each other, well, before we start ordering the scaffolding, let us at least rope off that bit, that unsafe bit, where people might be going underneath, and we'll call the church to prayer. They say, we'll pray about this matter first, before we order the scaffolding. And they did that. They had a church prayer gathering. Within the next 7 days after that prayer gathering, all the bits of metal fell harmlessly down into the roped-off area below. They needed not to have any scaffolding at all. The thing was solved. Now, there was a unity about that and a unanimity. The church said, here's something important. We'll pray about it. It is the test of our unity because prayer in unity is not a coalition by which, through sheer weight of numbers, we hope to compel God to act. It's not like that. It's not like a liberal SDP alliance. It's a family agreement. An agreement in which we say we are going to communicate together, as well as individually, with the head of our church and bring the matters that are upon our minds to him and see if we can't be in his will and help also to bring about his will as we pray. Prayer is the test of our unity. That's the first thing. Secondly, Prayer is the test of our sincerity. It is a test of sincerity because prayer can be a very inconvenient, even discouraging activity. You know that as well as I do. The church here in Acts 12 was praying virtually blind, in ignorance about Peter. They didn't know what had happened to their spokesman and leader. Not really. He was behind bars, but perhaps he was already dead, like James. They didn't know. But because it was their habit and their style to pray anyway, it's no surprise that in this crisis situation, they called the prayer gathering together and they prayed earnestly. So we read in verse 5. There's something about prayer. When it is earnest, that is to say, when it is premeditated and deliberate, its reverberations are very great. It says so in James chapter 5 and verse 16. In the Old Authorized Version, I know it, it says, "The fervent, effectual prayer of a righteous man availeth much." It must be fervent and in earnest. Somebody has said, and I can't remember who the Christian author was, he said once, "The wish that simply flits across the soul as the shadow of the cloud glides over the summer grass is no true prayer." It isn't so much that prayer is our way of bending God to our will, because that's more like magic. No, prayer is God's chosen way of involving you and me in the establishing of His will. His will, not my will. So we come to Him individually and collectively, as though to say, "Let us cooperate with your divine working and have the privilege of seeing your action result." And in any case, whether there is an answer that is obvious, whether there's a clear yes or a clear no, or maybe a wait, and all those can be the answer, we still love you anyway, and we're glad to talk to you and be in friendship. Earnest prayer, then, is not a special, holy kind of voice. There was a trend some years ago, I think in student circles, I seem to remember, when it was thought to be rather spiritual if you prayed in the public prayer gathering in a sort of mid-Atlantic accent. A slightly holy, different kind of voice. It is unnatural, really. But that's not it. You don't switch on a funny voice in order to sound holy or to be holy. It's not piling on the flowery phrases or to be heard for our much speaking. Frankly, it is coming, agreeing, blocking off that time, and doing it. It's a learnt thing. We're all learners, most of us. Somebody perhaps says, "Hey, but I am a beginner. I've only just started. A week ago as a Christian. I don't know how to pray at all." We'll teach you. Let us teach you. Get into one of these fellowship groups and you'll learn by doing it with the others how it's done, what prayer is about. But you can start to talk to Christ tonight anyway. You've probably begun. And that you talk to Him in your own everyday phrases. You make it up as you go along. You don't have to have a book. You can do it out of your own heart. Talk to Him. Sometimes people make little lists of the things they want to pray about. Sometimes people will have a monthly list and they'll pencil all the way through for the every day of the month. Others do it on a weekly basis. Then you meet some of these great men of prayer who say, "Oh, yes, I have a list like that." Then every now and then I know I feel frustrated with it. And I tear it up and I pray out of my heart for a while. Then I start again on another list. You're always fighting, always struggling, always learning. You never get to a point when you say, "I've got prayer absolutely worked out now." Nobody gets to that point. That's why we must be careful not to batter each other over the head and say, "Aren't you an awful person of prayer?" We're all learners. We're going to go on learning. It's a learnt thing. Maybe the developing countries have got a lot to teach us about prayer in the West. They seem often to have got the idea of persevering in their praying. We often get dazzled by the materialism and we turn off too soon. I'll give an example. Norman Saunders was the organizer of all the arrangements at the recently held Amsterdam Gathering Congress for Evangelism. Roger Simpson and I were both there. And Norman Saunders said to me one day that as he passed through the great Europa Hall of the Amsterdam Gathering, it was about the size of Waterloo Station, he said on that particular afternoon everybody had got the time off and so they could go out and shop and rest and so on. So he said that vast hall was empty except for one man who was there, an African. And he said, as I saw who it was, he said, I noticed that the man was on his knees on the bare concrete praying. That was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, he went on and did his other arrangements, and Norman Saunders came through the hall again by about 2:30, and he looked, and the man was still there praying. At 3 o'clock, he passed through the hall, and he saw that the man was still there on his knees praying, the man from Africa. At 4 o'clock, he said, he looked again, and the man was still there praying. And Norman Saunders said to himself, he's an American, he said, I don't understand how it is that this man can be there praying when only in that very uncomfortable situation, when only a few yards away, we have actually set up quite a comfortable prayer room where people can be praying. He said to himself, I'll just look inside the prayer room and see if anybody's using that. He looked in the prayer room. There were 4 people there. All 4 were fast asleep. We have lessons to learn. And sometimes the lessons come from unusual sources. We learn from one another. We learn from, yes, we can buy a book and learn about prayer, but the best way is to do it. Prayer in a church is the test of our unity. And it's also the test of our sincerity. Do I mean it? What am I wanting to do? Do I want to be in touch with God? It's the test of our sincerity. Thirdly, may I say this, that prayer is the test of our expectancy. I love the reaction of the prayer gathering in this chapter of Acts 12. Because the people prayed, we had in the reading how Peter was released from captivity, found himself on the street, went to the place of the prayer gathering, the house of Mary, knocked on the door, was confronted by Rhoda, the girl who came out, who was obviously watching the door that night, and she rushed back into the prayer gathering. It's Peter, he's out, he's at the door now. They couldn't believe it. Disturbance in the prayer gathering. Church warden, could you come? We've got a disturbed girl here. She needs a glass of water. And now next we're going to pray for Herod. You can imagine how the prayer gathering could have gone on in that vein. They could not believe it. But Rhoda persisted and finally persuaded them that she was not seeing things and it wasn't his ghost or anything like that. And so the door is opened and there was Peter, the rock man as large as life. What does it say at the end of verse 16? They saw him and were amazed. Luke, the master of understatement again. They were amazed. That's just the lovely and wonderful thing about prayer. Throughout the history of praying people across the centuries, invariably, we are surprised out of our socks when we hear that something's happened and an answer has come. And then we gasp, why, God actually heard. He must have been listening to my prayer. We cannot believe it. It's wonderful to see it here in this chapter, this surprise of the praying people, because then I learned from that these people were just like me. But it's the test, nevertheless, of our expectation and expectancy to keep on in our prayers, both privately and jointly, because we know that God uses it as a force in his church and in his world to keep on. Maybe God has given you something to pray about and you don't see the answer coming. And even 5 minutes before the answer comes, it still seems a million miles away. But we don't give up. We keep on. There's something about prayer. So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. One day, maybe, our own prayer gathering here at All Souls will outgrow that Waldegrave Hall downstairs. In a way, we hope it won't, because it's quite cosy there in the Waldegrave Hall, and even though there are usually about 300 of us praying there, there's a sense of togetherness in that place. And yet it would be wonderful to find that our own private life of prayer, overspilt to the extent that hundreds and hundreds of people found in their hearts that they wanted to pray together regularly, with the earnestness of hard work, which is what it is, and intercession, travelling in from work on the bus or on the underground, seeing and practicing these principles of prayer. There are examples of people who have persisted, and they keep on. I'll give one further example, out of so many that you and I could probably think of. I remember meeting the actress, Joan Windmill Brown. And I remember the story of her conversion, which she's written up, of course. She was a West End actress here, years back. 12,000 miles away, at the time when she was in despair, the other side of the world, in New South Wales, in Australia, a man had been praying for her conversion. His name was Elwood Fisher. He'd been looking at an Australian film magazine those years back, and his eye fell upon the picture of this actress, Joan Windmill. Having nothing to do with the movies, really, he wasn't particularly impressed, but all the same, he felt an impulse that he should pray for this person. Why, he didn't know, but he did. He began quietly to pray for the conversion of Joan Windmill. He prayed and prayed, and he went on for a long time. Week after week passed. And in 1954, he says, he felt the burden lift off him that he should now cease praying for Joan Windmill. So he dropped her from his prayer list. He didn't know why. And much later, he knew the reason. Joan Windmill had been to hear the evangelist Billy Graham at one of his great crusades in London and had turned to Jesus Christ. The prayer had been answered. You get just sometimes the curtain being lifted a little bit so that we can see what has been happening behind the scenes. For this is a behind-the-scenes kind of work, praying. We find it hard, and the discipline is difficult, especially in this matter of daily prayer. Who of us does not find it difficult? Perhaps it's one of the indications that there is a devil, that we find it hard to pray and get down to it and to persevere, being in touch with our Creator and communicating with Him and being used of Him to fulfill His will. What are these principles here in this little story? I think those are three. Prayer is a test of our unity in the church, a test of our sincerity, and a test of our expectancy. Prayer was made by the church for Him. Gypsy Smith, the great preacher of old, once said in a sermon, "In the model church, the people will love to pray. They will love that more than anything else. They would rather go to a prayer meeting than to a place of entertainment. When the Church of God," he said, "uses the apostolic standard, it will be a praying church. That will be its chief characteristic. These people prayed."